Hey everyone, and welcome to our deep dive today. We are going to be looking at something pretty interesting, and maybe a little unsettling.
Oh.
Yeah, it has to do with how private equity returns are measured and reported.
Okay.
Specifically, we're going to be exploring an academic paper called The Tyranny of IRR.
Okay.
Which, by the way, was partly funded by the CFA Institute.
Interesting.
This paper takes a hard look at a metric that has become almost synonymous with private equity success.
I think I know what you're going to say.
The internal rate of return.
IRR. Yeah, that's a big one.
Or IRR for short.
Right. It's almost like a magic number in private equity.
Yeah, exactly.
The promise of, you know, incredible returns often seems to just dwarf what we see in the public markets.
Mm.
But this paper, it argues that IRR can be incredibly misleading.
Yeah.
Especially when you really look closely at the assumptions that are built into the calculation.
Okay, so let's break this down a little bit.
Yeah.
Before we get into the paper's specific critiques, can you just remind us, for the listeners, what is IRR?
Yeah.
And, you know, why is it so widely used in the private equity world?
Of course.
Yeah.
So at its core, IRR is just a way to calculate the effective rate of return on an investment.
Okay.
It's the discount rate that makes the net present value of all cash flows from an investment equal to zero.
Okay.
It's basically trying to answer the question, what annualized return would I need to earn on my initial investment to get to that final value?
Okay.
Taking into account all the, you know, cash flows in between.
Sounds pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
Where's the catch?
Well, the catch is
the
catch lies in a crucial assumption that IRR makes.
Okay.
It assumes that all the distributions you receive from a private equity fund can be reinvested at the same IRR.
Oh, at the same IRR. Okay.
So if a fund reports, say, like a 30% IRR, it's assuming that you can continuously find other investments that also deliver a 30% return.
Right.
And that's where the problem starts.
Yeah. That does seem like a pretty optimistic assumption.
It is.
Especially when you consider that private equity is often touted as generating these outsized returns.
Right.
Far beyond what you would typically find in public markets.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Finding investments that consistently deliver 20, 30, or even higher returns year after year is incredibly difficult, if not impossible.
Yeah.
And the paper argues that this reinvestment assumption is a major reason why IRRs can be so misleading.
Yeah.
It creates this sort of mathematical illusion that just doesn't reflect reality.
So it's not that private equity firms are necessarily being like dishonest or anything.
Right.
It's that the metric itself has these flaws.
It does, yeah.
Built in that can create this distorted picture of their performance.
And the paper actually dives into some real world examples to illustrate just how dramatic this distortion can be.
Okay, I'm all ears. Give me an example.
So take Terra Firma, for instance. Back in 2002, they were making waves with their very first private equity fund.
Right.
They boasted this stellar 62% IRR.
Wow.
It was enough to attract like a massive amount of capital, making it the largest European fund at the time.
Really?
But when you look at their actual returns, the money multiple they returned to investors was only 2.1 times the initial investment.
Wait, so a 62% IRR translates to just a little over doubling your money?
Yeah, that's right.
Something doesn't seem to add up here.
It doesn't. Okay. And it gets even more interesting.
Okay.
The paper points out that Terra Firma essentially went belly up later on.
Oh, wow.
Due to poor performance. Their actual track record was nowhere near what their reported IRR suggested.
Wow, that's a pretty stark example.
It is.
Of how IRR can create a disconnect.
It really is.
Between perception and reality.
Right.
Do they give any other examples?
Oh, yeah, they do.
Yeah.
They highlight Apax Partners.
Okay.
Another big name in private equity. Back in 2007, a prominent pension fund recommended investing in their seventh fund.
Okay.
Solely based on their reported 51% IRR over the previous 15 years.
Wow.
No other performance metrics were even considered.
Oh, wow.
This led to Apax Seventh raising like a staggering 17 billion euros.
Wow.
Making it the second largest fund in Europe at the time.
Okay. So what happened?
Well,
did they live up to the hype?
Not even close.
What?
After 18 long years.
Oh my gosh.
Apax 7th finally liquidated its last investments.
Okay.
And they achieved a 7.6% IRR.
Oh, wow. Okay.
That's a far cry from the 51% that was initially touted.
Yeah, that's, yeah, that is a far cry.
Right. And their money multiple.
Yeah.
1.5 times the initial investment.
Okay. I'm starting to see the problem here.
Yeah.
It's like being promised this 5-star meal.
Right.
And ending up with a, like, microwave TV dinner.
Yeah.
You know, there's this huge gap between the expectation and the reality.
That's a great analogy.
Yeah, yeah.
The paper argues that these examples aren't just isolated incidents.
Ah, right. They point to this systemic issue with how IRR is used and interpreted in private equity.
Right.
It's a metric that can easily create unrealistic expectations and lead to disappointment.
Yeah.
Even for sophisticated investors.
This is fascinating, but I have to admit, it's also a bit unsettling, you know?
Yeah.
I feel like we need to be a lot more critical when we see those really impressive IRR numbers being thrown around.
Right.
But before we get into that,
sure.
I am curious about something else the paper mentioned.
Okay.
This idea of since inception IRR.
Right.
And how that can be even more problematic than just a regular IRR.
It can be.
Can you explain what that is?
Sure. Since inception IRR, or SI-IRR,
okay.
is simply the IRR calculated from the very beginning of a firm or fund's life.
Okay.
The problem is that it includes massive early distributions.
Yeah.
Which, as we've discussed, can skew the results dramatically.
So it's like judging a baseball player's entire career based solely on their rookie season stats.
You know, they might have been a phenomenal rookie.
Right.
But that doesn't mean they'll maintain that level of performance throughout their career.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And SIRR can create this illusion of consistent outsized performance.
Right.
Even if the firm's more recent returns are much more modest.
Okay.
It creates this sort of performance halo.
Interesting.
That can be misleading for investors.
Okay, I'm starting to get a sense of how SIRR can really distort that picture even further.
Yeah.
But can you give me like a really concrete example?
Absolutely. Yeah. Of how this plays out in the real world. Take KKR, okay. one of the most, you know, well-known and respected private equity firms.
Yeah, of course.
Their early investments back in the 1970s and 80s were incredibly successful, generating a 26% IRR and a 3x money multiple.
Okay.
But their performance after 1999 has been significantly lower.
Really?
Yeah. Their net IRR dropped to around 12%.
Wow.
And their gross multiple was only 1.8 times.
So their more recent performance is basically half.
Pretty much.
Of what it was in their early days.
That's right.
Huh. Interesting.
However,
yeah.
their reported SIIR has remained practically unchanged over the years.
Oh, wow.
Still hovering around 26%.
So it's almost as if those early wins have created this permanent performance anchor.
It has.
That masks any subsequent decline in their returns.
It's like they're coasting on the fumes of past glory.
Yeah, exactly.
But their reported SIIR just doesn't reflect that.
Right.
And what's even more striking is that according to the paper, KKR's overall SIRR is practically immune to whatever happens with their newer investments.
Really?
Even if they were to lose all the money they've invested since 1999.
Oh my God.
Their reported SIRR would barely budge.
Wow.
It's a completely distorted picture of their actual performance trajectory.
So it sounds like even the most prestigious private equity firms can benefit from this SIIR illusion.
That's right.
Wow.
Okay. And KKR is not alone. The paper also points to Apollo Global Management.
Yeah.
Another major player in the industry.
Mm-hmm.
They've been reporting a consistent 39% gross IRR.
Wow.
Since they went public back in 2008.
Every year.
Every single year. It's the same number.
It's like they've discovered some magical formula.
Right.
For generating constant returns.
It just doesn't seem plausible.
Yeah.
It doesn't, does it? And it all goes back to that reinvestment assumption.
Right.
If you assume that those early distributions have been compounding at these incredibly high rates for decades,
yeah.
then of course your overall SIRR will remain sky high.
Right.
No matter what happens with your more recent investments.
Okay. I'm starting to see how this SIIRR thing can be even more misleading than the regular IRR.
It can be.
You know, it's like building a castle on a foundation of sand.
Oh. I like that.
You know, it might look impressive from the outside.
Right.
But it's not built to last.
Yeah, a great analogy. And you know what's even more fascinating?
What's that?
This IRR and Psi-IRR fixation extends even to the hallowed halls of the Yale Endowment.
Really?
Often considered the gold standard of institutional investing.
Yeah.
And a pioneer in allocating so heavily to private equity.
You mean the same Yale Endowment?
Yes.
That was reporting 30.4% annualized returns?
Yes.
From private equity?
Yes.
And inspired countless others to jump on the bandwagon.
Yes.
The one that practically wrote the book on the Yale model.
The very same.
Wow. Okay.
And here's where it gets really interesting.
Okay.
The paper reveals that Yale has never publicly disclosed its money multiples for its private equity portfolio.
Really?
They've been fixated on reporting this single metric, the IRR, without providing any context or revealing the actual cash flow patterns.
Yeah, that's surprising.
It is.
You'd think an institution like Yale, known for its rigorous approach to investing,
right,
would be more transparent about their performance.
You would, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I would.
And when confronted about the potential flaws of using IRR as the primary performance metric, their response was essentially, well, everyone else is doing it, so we have to as well.
So they admit to using a potentially misleading metric.
Yes.
Just to keep up with the Joneses.
That's pretty much it.
That's disappointing, to say the least.
Yeah.
But did they ever come clean about their actual returns?
They did.
Okay.
But in a rather subtle way.
How so?
In their 2020 annual report,
okay,
they quietly revealed their 20-year IRR for leveraged buyouts.
Okay.
Which was a much more modest 11.2%.
Okay. Still decent returns.
Yeah.
But a far cry from that 30% figure.
That's right.
That had been so widely publicized.
Right.
It seems like the Yale model, at least in terms of reported returns, was built on a foundation that might be less solid than many people assume.
That's a good way to put it.
Yeah.
And it reinforces the paper's central argument.
Yeah.
We need to be incredibly cautious when interpreting those headline IRR numbers.
Right.
Even when they come from seemingly impeccable sources like Yale.
This is all incredibly insightful.
Good.
But I'm curious. Where do we go from here?
Yeah.
You know, if IRRs are so problematic, especially those IRRs,
right,
is there a better way to measure private equity returns?
That's a great question.
Yeah.
And it's one that the paper explores in detail.
Okay, I like where this is going.
They introduce the concept of horizon IRRs.
Horizon IRRs.
Okay, which offers a potentially more reliable way to evaluate private equity returns.
Okay, so horizon IRRs, I like the sound of that.
Yeah.
It sounds like we're about to move from like the dark ages of IRR into a more like enlightened era.
Exactly.
Of performance measurement, but I guess we'll have to save that discussion for part two.
We will.
Of our deep dive. So join us then as we explore this new frontier of private equity returns.
Sounds good.
Okay, so we're back, ready to continue our exploration of private equity returns.
Absolutely.
You know, in part one, we really unpacked the potential pitfalls of IRRs.
Yes.
Especially those long-term since inception figures, but you know, I'm feeling optimistic.
Good.
Because you mentioned something called horizon IRRs.
Yes.
Which sound promising. Can you tell me more about those?
Sure. Horizon IRRs, sometimes called NAV to NAVI IRRs.
Okay.
They offer a different lens, you could say, through which to view private equity performance.
Okay.
So instead of calculating the IRR from the very beginning of a fund or a firm's existence, they focus on specific time windows.
Okay.
Like the past 5, 10, 15, or 20 years.
So instead of one long, potentially misleading IRR figure,
right,
we get a series of snapshots over time.
Exactly.
Okay, that sounds like a much more nuanced approach.
It is. It helps mitigate the influence of those potentially inflated early distributions that can make IRRs look so impressive.
Right.
Think about it this way.
Okay.
If you're evaluating an investment today.
Yeah.
How relevant is, you know, a stellar performance from 25 years ago?
Right.
Markets change, strategies evolve, and past performance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it doesn't guarantee future results.
Right.
Horizon IRRs, they bring the focus to more recent, arguably more relevant periods.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
But does the paper actually, like, show how horizon IRRs can give us a more accurate picture?
It does. Remember KKR?
Yeah.
The firm whose IRR has remained, you know,
Stubbornly high.
yes, stubbornly high.
Despite their dip in performance in recent decades.
Exactly. Well, their
Yeah.
20-year horizon IRR is around 12%,
Okay.
which aligns much better with their money multiple and
Right.
their performance since 1999. It's a figure that feels a lot more grounded in reality.
Compared to that 26% Psi-IRR.
That's a great example.
Yeah.
So Horizon IRRs seem to be, you know, less susceptible to manipulation
Yeah.
because they're not anchored to those potentially inflated early distributions.
That's right.
Plus, they give us like a clearer view
Yeah.
of how performance trends have evolved over time.
Exactly.
So are Horizon IRRs the ultimate solution?
Well,
Have we finally found the Holy Grail?
I wouldn't go that far.
Okay.
They are definitely a step in the right direction,
Okay.
but they're not a silver bullet.
Of course, there's always a catch. What are some of the downsides?
Well, one limitation is that you do inevitably lose some historical information.
Okay.
So if a firm had an incredible run, 25 years ago,
Yeah.
but has been mediocre ever since,
Right.
that early success won't show up in their 20-year horizon IRR.
Right.
But as we discussed,
How relevant is ancient history when you're evaluating an investment today?
true. Things change so much in the investment world,
They do.
especially in dynamic fields like private equity.
Exactly.
Yeah. What are some other potential drawbacks?
Well, Horizon IRRs can still be influenced by unusually strong or weak periods in the past.
Okay.
For instance, the dot-com bubble of the late 1990s, while over two decades ago,
Yeah.
can still distort 20-year horizon IRR figures.
Okay.
So those outsized returns from that era,
Right.
driven by a unique and unsustainable market environment,
Yeah.
can skew the picture,
Right.
even if a firm's performance has been more moderate since.
Ah, so the ghosts of the dot-com boom can still linger,
They can.
even with Horizon IRRs.
Yes.
Any other potential issues we should be aware of?
There's one more that's often overlooked, and
Yeah.
it has to do with net asset values
Okay.
or NVs. If
Okay.
a fund consistently uses like conservative NAVs,
Okay.
meaning they underestimate the true market value of their holdings, their horizon IRRs can actually be biased upwards.
Wait, so being conservative with your valuations
Right.
can actually backfire and make your performance look better than it actually is?
It can.
That seems counterintuitive.
It does, but think about it.
Yeah.
If you start with an NAV that's too low
Okay.
and you end with an NAV that's also too low,
Yeah.
but you have decent cash flows in between the IRR calculation, can make it seem like you've achieved a higher return than you really have.
So even with Horizon IRRs,
Yeah.
there's still, room for some,
There is.
let's say, creative accounting to influence those results.
It's a good reminder that we always need to be critical thinkers.
Yeah.
No single metric, even a seemingly robust one like Horizon IRR,
Yeah.
can tell the whole story.
Right.
We have to consider the context, the methodology, and always dig a little deeper.
Okay, so Horizon IRRs are a helpful tool, but they're not a foolproof solution.
Correct.
What other things should we be looking at
Yeah.
when we're trying to assess private equity returns?
Even with Horizon IRRs, you still want to compare them to relevant benchmarks.
Okay.
But this is where things can get tricky again,
Okay.
because benchmark selection
Yeah.
can significantly impact how performance is presented.
It's like that saying, right? Everything's relative.
Yes.
Depending on what you're comparing something to,
Right.
it can look very different.
Exactly. For instance, some private equity firms might choose to benchmark their performance against the MSCI World Index,
Okay.
which is this broad global equity index.
Yeah.
But if you compare their returns to a more focused index, like the
Okay.
FAMA French Small Cap Index,
Right.
the results might be quite different.
So by carefully choosing their benchmark,
Yeah.
they can make their performance look better.
It's possible.
Even if they're not actually outperforming the broader market.
It's not always about intentional manipulation.
Right.
Sometimes it's just a matter of emphasizing the data
Yeah.
that supports their narrative,
Right.
but it highlights the importance of looking beyond those headline figures
Yeah.
and understanding the methodology behind the comparisons.
Okay, I'm starting to see how benchmark selection can be a bit of a minefield.
It can be.
Are there any other tactics we should be aware of?
Oh, absolutely.
When it comes to comparing private equity returns to benchmarks.
There's a couple other things to watch out for.
Okay.
One is sector weighting.
Okay.
Remember how we discussed that private equity funds often have a higher concentration?
Yeah.
In specific sectors?
Yeah, yeah, like technology?
Yes, like technology or healthcare.
Yeah, and those sectors have been on a tear in recent years.
Exactly. Yeah. So if you compare their returns to a broad market index, mm-hmm. that includes sectors that haven't performed as well,
yeah.
it creates this false impression of outperformance.
Right.
It's like comparing a basketball team that specializes in three-pointers
yeah.
to a team that focuses on free throws. They're playing different games.
Right, yeah.
Right.
So even if a private equity fund is doing well,
mm-hmm.
it might not be doing as well as it seems.
It might not.
If you adjust for those sector biases.
That's right.
Okay, what's the other tactic you mentioned?
It's a bit sneaky.
Okay.
Some firms will actually exclude certain industries from their performance calculations.
Huh, interesting.
Such as commodities, real estate, or oil and gas.
Really?
Even though those sectors are included in the public equity benchmarks well, they're yeah. being compared to.
Why would they do that?
Well, conveniently,
yeah.
those excluded sectors often have lower returns
right, yeah.
than the sectors that private equity typically invests in.
Right.
So by cherry picking which industries they include in their performance figures,
they yeah. can create a much more flattering picture.
So it's like playing a card game where you get to choose which cards to keep
yes.
and which ones to discard.
Exactly.
Not exactly a level playing field.
Not at all.
And it's not just about the benchmarks themselves.
Right.
The time periods used for comparison can also be manipulated to make the results look better.
Yes.
For example, a private equity fund might choose to highlight their returns over a specific time frame
yes.
that coincides with a particularly strong market upswing.
Exactly.
Even though that might not be representative of their long-term performance.
Right. They're essentially cherry-picking the periods that make them look the best.
Yeah.
Even if it doesn't reflect the bigger picture.
So it's starting to feel like a game of private equity smoke and mirrors here.
It can.
It sounds like we need to become detectives to uncover all these subtle ways performance can be manipulated.
It does take a discerning eye.
And a healthy dose of skepticism.
What's the most important thing our listeners should keep in mind when they encounter these comparisons to benchmarks?
The key is awareness.
Okay.
Always be aware of the potential for bias.
Yeah.
And never hesitate to ask the right questions.
Mm-hmm.
Don't just take performance data at face value.
Right.
Dig deeper, understand the methodology, and look for any red flags that might suggest manipulation.
It's like buying a used car.
Mm-hmm.
You know? You wouldn't just take the seller's word for it.
Right.
You'd want to get a vehicle history report.
Yes.
Have a mechanic check it out.
Exactly.
Definitely take it for a test drive before you make a decision.
That's a perfect analogy.
Yeah.
You need to do your due diligence
yeah.
in the investment world too.
Right.
And if something seems too good to be true, well, it probably is.
This has been incredibly insightful. We've covered so much ground
from the
limitations of IRRs
yeah.
to the nuances of horizon IRRs
mm-hmm.
and the potential pitfalls of benchmark comparisons.
Right.
But it feels like there's even more to uncover.
There is.
What other fascinating insights await us in part three of our deep dive?
Well, we're going to shift gears a bit in part three.
Okay.
And we're going to explore some specific cases
okay.
of benchmark gaming.
Oh, okay.
We'll see how even sophisticated investors,
right.
like pension funds and endowments,
yeah.
can fall prey to the allure of seemingly stellar returns.
Yeah.
Even when those returns might be more illusion than reality.
That sounds fascinating. I can't wait to hear those stories and see how all of this plays out in the real world.
It'll be interesting.
So join us for the final chapter of our deep dive.
Yeah.
As we continue to unravel the mysteries of private equity returns.
Yeah.
Welcome back to our deep dive, everybody. So in parts one and two, we really dug into the mechanics of IRRs.
Yeah.
You know, those tricky horizon IRRs.
Mm-hmm.
And we even saw how benchmarks themselves
right.
can be Well, let's say massaged.
They can be.
But now I'm really curious.
Yeah.
Because you mentioned some real-world examples.
I did.
Of how even savvy investors
yeah.
can be fooled by these tactics.
Yeah.
So let's hear about those.
You're right. Even the most sophisticated investors aren't immune to the allure of these seemingly spectacular returns.
Right.
One example that comes to mind is the California Public Employees Retirement System.
CalPERS.
Better known as CalPERS.
Yeah.
They're one of the largest pension funds in the world.
Yeah.
Managing this vast portfolio right. that includes, you know, significant allocations to private equity.
Okay, so CalPERS, that's a big name.
Big.
I'm guessing they have a team of experts.
They do.
Carefully scrutinizing every investment.
Yes.
So how did they get like caught up in this benchmark gaming?
Well, back in 2015, oh. CalPERS came under fire for how they were reporting their private equity performance.
Oh, okay.
It turned out
yeah.
they were using a custom benchmark
yeah.
that, according to critics, was designed to make their private equity returns look better than they actually were.
A custom? Okay, so a custom benchmark.
Yes.
How does that even work?
So instead of using a standard publicly available benchmark,
right.
they created their own.
Oh.
And this custom benchmark, some argued, was heavily weighted toward sectors
okay.
that private equity typically favored,
right.
like technology and healthcare,
right, right.
while underweighting sectors that hadn't performed as well.
Right. So they essentially rigged the game in their favor.
Wow.
By crafting a benchmark that was almost guaranteed to make them look good.
It's not quite as simple as that.
Okay.
CalPERS defended their approach,
okay.
saying that their custom benchmark was more representative of their actual private equity portfolio.
Okay.
They argued it was a more accurate way to measure their performance.
I see. So it's their word against the critics.
Exactly. It's a matter of perspective yeah. and interpretation.
Yep.
But this case highlights the importance of transparency and clear communication
yeah.
when it comes to performance reporting.
Right.
Even if CalPERS genuinely believed their custom benchmark was the most appropriate,
yeah.
the lack of transparency created suspicion
sure.
and raised questions about whether they were trying to mask underperformance.
That makes sense if you're not open about how you're measuring your performance,
right.
it's easy for people to assume you're hiding something.
Exactly.
Do you have any other examples?
I do. Of this kind of benchmark manipulation, there's another case
okay.
involving the Washington State Investment Board,
okay.
another massive pension fund.
Okay.
They faced scrutiny
yeah.
for using a private equity benchmark that was actually managed by one of their own investment consultants.
Wait, so they were essentially being graded
right.
by someone who had a financial stake in their success.
Right. Critics argued this created a conflict of interest.
That's a huge red flag.
As the consultant had an incentive to make the benchmark look favorable
right.
to the funds that they were recommending.
It certainly raised concerns.
It did.
Did he have anything to say about that?
Well, the Washington State Investment Board argued that the consultant was chosen through a competitive bidding process.
Okay.
And that their methodology was sound.
Okay.
But the optics weren't great.
Yeah.
And it led to calls for greater independence and transparency
right.
in benchmark selection.
I can see why it's like having your best friend grade your exam.
Exactly.
You know, you might get a good grade.
Right.
But no one's gonna take it seriously.
Exactly. These cases highlight the importance of independent verification
yeah.
and third-party validation when it comes to performance data.
Right.
It's not enough to simply trust the numbers
right.
presented by, you know, fund managers or investment consultants.
Right.
Investors need to dig deeper, ask tough questions, mm-hmm. and seek independent perspectives to get a truly objective view of performance.
Wow, these examples are truly eye-opening.
They are.
You know, it's clear that benchmark manipulation isn't just some theoretical concept.
Yeah.
It's a real problem that can affect even the most sophisticated investors.
Right.
I have to say this entire deep dive has been both fascinating and a bit unsettling.
Yeah.
You know, it's made me realize that there's a lot more to private equity returns than meets the eye.
I'm glad you found it insightful.
I have.
The key takeaway is this. Never be complacent.
Yeah.
Always question the numbers.
Right.
Understand the context mm-hmm. and demand transparency.
Yes.
Knowledge is power.
Yes.
And the more you know about how private equity returns are measured and reported,
mm-hmm.
the better equipped you'll be to navigate this complex world.
Right.
And make informed investment decisions.
Well said. I think this deep dive has armed our listeners with the knowledge and the critical thinking skills.
I hope so.
They need to be. To be savvy investors in the private equity space.
Yes.
So remember, everyone, don't be afraid to challenge the conventional wisdom.
Right.
Ask the tough questions.
Yes.
And always do your due diligence.
Absolutely.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.
It was a pleasure being here.